there. You're listening to the Park Rush podcast. This is a theme park podcast. I'm Tom, and this week we are rather scraping the bottom of the barrel when it comes to guests. No Josh this week. No other backups, usual backups available. So I've turned to someone I never thought I would have to turn to. It's my mum. Hello, mum.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for that introduction.
And we're here to talk about Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Orlando, which we did during our recent trip to Florida. Maybe one of the most exciting parts of the trip going in, because it was one of the few things that we've never done before in all the years of going to Florida. We're planning, I think, to make this a two-part podcast because there's quite a lot to get through, and we did it all over the course of two nights. So we'll do night one and then night two. But before we dive into night one, I think, as always, you took control of the booking process for this. Do you remember how it all worked and how much it cost and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so we booked all of the theme park tickets in June via attractiontickets.com. Booked the Disney passes, the Universal passes, and we booked two nights for the Halloween nights. And we went for Wednesdays because we thought weekends might be ultra busy. The prices changed depending on what day you booked. So I think the first week we went was £72 each. And the second week we went was £75 each. And that was on top of, obviously, the Universal theme park ticket as well. So what we found out afterwards, once we were there, was that you didn't get access to the Halloween nights unless you had a day ticket until about 6:30, I think it was, 6 o'clock, 6:30?
Yeah, I think so. So I'm not sure why you would do this, but you can just get a Halloween-only ticket. And then, yeah, it doesn't open until 6:30 p.m. if that's the case. And they sort of hold you at the gate and they put on a show. It's kind of like a sick, twisted version of what they do at Magic Kingdom when Mickey and friends get off the train, except this time it's like undead and zombies and vampires all sort of threatening to kill you and that kind of thing. So it's a slightly different vibe. But because we had day tickets, technically, because we had a two-week ticket, right,
yeah,
for the parks. So in those instances, if you're one of those people, on a day where Horror Nights is happening, they close Universal at 5, right? So if you don't have Halloween tickets on those days and are in the park, they'll start ushering you out, or you'll have to go over to Islands of Adventure or something like that.
Yeah.
But for us, on both days, we rocked up at probably about 4, just before 4. And it's encouraged because that is about as much time as you're going to need to get into position for when the mazes start to actually open.
There's one other way you could do it, which I didn't realise before we booked the tickets, but I think they do like an early entry for the Halloween nights. So you get your Halloween night ticket, but if you haven't got a day ticket, you can pay an extra. I think it was about $40 per person to get in about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. So it allows you to get in the queues early without having the full day ticket. But
it's much more complicated than it used to be buying theme park tickets. The important thing to remember, though, is that everyone paid their way and everyone bought their own tickets, and there was no scrounging off Bank of Mum and Dad on this trip. We're all grown adults who bought our own tickets.
Big smirk on your face as you say that.
We'll move on. This is an audio podcast. Visual references will go over everyone's head. So night one, as I say, we rocked up at about 4 o'clock. And before we get into what we actually did, what were your expectations going in? Because you have the reputation in the family of being the most prone to jump scares and things like that.
I was a bit nervous, I have to admit. Someone can walk in the kitchen and I've got their back to them and I jump out of my skin if they say hello to me. So I was a bit worried going into this and a bit anxious about it, has to be said. But we'll take one for the family, something we've never done before, as you were saying. So, wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, perhaps.
Mm. And did you have any expectations for each of the mazes? Because I think, as is the case every year, they sort of break it up between mazes that are based on franchises that you'll recognise, some of which are Universal Zone and some of which are ones they've gone and done deals for, like Stranger Things, and then other ones are completely original creations for Horror Nights. So were there any houses in particular that you were trepidatious about or interested in going in?
I think because they kind of drip feed, didn't they, a little bit about which mazes or which haunted houses were going to be there when, you know, between the time we bought the tickets and we actually arrived. So I think Stranger Things and The Last of Us were the ones that probably more excited about because we know what they are. Some of the ones I didn't really know the theme, so I've never seen the Chucky film, so didn't really know what to expect there.
But we decided on night one anyway to prioritise The Last of Us. And what this involves is, as I said, we're in the parks at about 4. Halloween opens officially at 6:30, but they sort of start to open the houses on a kind of staggered basis from about 5:15, I think. And The Last of Us, I think, for people who were in the park early, maybe opened at around 5:45, something like that. So what it basically means is that from 4-ish until about then, you're not actually even in the queue, technically. You're in what they call these stay-and-scream areas.
Like a holding area, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a holding area. And there are 3 of them dotted around the park, I think, each one positioned for the different houses. And I think the one we were in, which is closest to Springfield, so they kind of hold you in Central Park. So a good opportunity to grab a crepe, perhaps, before you head in, which is what I did, to keep yourself occupied. But you stay in there, in our case, for well over an hour, and then eventually they will escort you in an orderly fashion to the actual queue for whichever house you want to do. And obviously for us, it was The Last of Us. And then from there, we were queuing again for
an hour, wasn't it? I think it was just over 2 hours in total.
Maybe.
Because the holding area wasn't just for The Last of Us. There was like another perhaps 2 houses.
I think The Monsters Unmasked, I think, was one of the other ones for that holding area. I'm not sure about if there was another one.
It was really hot because the only problem with those holding areas, there's not much shade there. And it was quite a hot afternoon.
Mm.
So people were like, I'd recommend taking some at least some bottles of water with you if you're in that queue for like 2 hours. People were like, you could go out of the queue and the holding area to use the restrooms or to go and get a drink or something to eat. But a lot of people just didn't move because I think they were a bit worried about losing their space. And you don't really know how far away you are from the entrance to the maze, the house.
Yeah, especially if you're coming in fresh. There were clearly quite a lot of people who were, if not confused, at least a little unsure about exactly how it all worked and were asking lots of questions of the Universal staff there. They seem to have a lot of staff dedicated to just standing around asking questions, answering questions. So they obviously anticipate that some people, especially if you're there for the first time, are maybe going to be a bit confused about how it all works. But, you know.
I think the only confusing bit when you go in is where you actually go for the holding areas because there were you got to... I think, didn't we go up towards the mummy at first and there wasn't a way through, so we had to sort of backtrack and go around the other way by Transformers to get in there. So it's not necessarily that clear when you first arrive at the park what direction you have to go in.
I think part of the problem as well is that people get there so early and start getting in line for the houses so early that you think you're heading in the right direction for a particular holding area and then quickly find out that because the queue to get into it is already built up so much that you need to kind of go off out of your way to actually find the back of the queue for the holding area you want, not the holding area itself. So, yeah, that's all a bit procedural. We won't bother talking about all this again on the second part of our Halloween episode. We can just dive straight into the houses. But I think that's everything in terms of like the procedural stuff and the operational stuff. We can probably just talk about the houses now, I guess.
So the only thing I had to mention is I got slightly worried about as we were going in and showing the tickets and I overheard at least like 2 families say like, I'd never do this without the fast pass.
Oh yeah, you can get an express pass, which was that $150?
Oh, it's more than that. So we obviously didn't do it for the first day, but then we did look to see how much you'd have to pay for that for the second day we were there. And it was about $200 each.
Yeah, there was a point in that Last of Us holding area in the hot afternoon sun where I think we considered giving in.
Giving them more money.
Which is exactly what they want. It's exactly the same sort of mentality as all the Disney Lightning Lane stuff. They hope that if you haven't bought one in advance, you'll turn up, realise how much easier it will make your life potentially and do it.
But if you remember, Tom, when we did get that, like the following day, we did check the Fastpass price and they'd sold out
for
the next Wednesday anyway. So it wouldn't have been an option for us anyway. So that shows how many people actually buy those Fastpass.
Yeah. I suppose it maybe is a bit of a sunk cost fallacy, but if you've already spent $100 to turn up, and then because of the queues you only get two houses done, you might think, well, I should just spend the extra $150, $200 to make sure I at least, because I'd imagine if you get a fast pass, enough people get them that you still are in a queue of some description, but obviously it's much shorter, and you probably will get all 10 done in a night if you have it. You'd probably still have to stay very late, though.
Yeah, I guess because we knew we were going back for a second night, it didn't worry us so much. But I think if you were only going for the one night, that's something you might consider.
Yeah, and as we'll get to in part two, it was raining a lot. The weather was not great on our second night. I think that ended up helping us in terms of the wait times for some houses. I don't think it was quite as busy as it was the first night. Anyway, so The Last of Us then... I thought this one was, in the context of it being our very first one, I probably found this the most, quote unquote, scary. Personally, if I'm going to find like a film or a video game or something horror related scary, the stuff that tends to get me is when there's sort of a lot of tension and a lot of build up and a lot of suspense, and then the scary stuff happens. That tends to be when it gets me. It's sort of the fear of the scare more than the scare itself. But in the case of almost all of these houses, it's basically crash, bang, wallop constantly. So I found it was more of like an adrenaline thing than a scare thing. But I think because this was the first one...
We didn't really know what to expect.
Yeah, this one was probably the most intense just because, you didn't really know what to expect, but... It's quite a good mix. It sort of starts with a bit of a shootout, I think. So for people that don't know The Last of Us, post-apocalypse, there's a zombie apocalypse, but it's all sort of fungus-based. So you've got, much like any zombie stuff, you've not just got the zombies, but you've got the real monsters, nasty humans with guns and clubs and bats and stuff. So it's a kind of a mix between the scare actors being... bandits and raiders, and then some of them being the monsters from The Last of Us. And as a fan, I was most excited to see just how good the sort of makeup and the prosthetics were on all of the zombies, the infected. So the runners, the clickers, the bloater, they're all represented through the house, and I thought that looked really good. It looked really good in the TV show, and it kind of just felt like I was walking through the TV show set, to be honest. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I must admit that first one is a little bit of a blur to me because going back to the thing, like, I get jumped quite easily. So I think I was kind of had a bit of a tunnel vision. So I thought if I don't look all the way around, nothing's going to scare me too much. But we went in, you have to go in single file. So we had like, I think we went in the same order for every time. So it was like Dad, me, Becky, Fleabag, and you at the back. And Becky was holding on to my shoulder strap of my bag. And I think it was her screaming every time that someone jumped out that made me more like scared because I didn't know what was going on behind me.
Yeah, she's not here to defend herself, but she's very much a play it cool, play it cool, play it cool, and then absolutely lose it and claim that she didn't. But she definitely did in most of these houses and definitely The Last of Us one. But they're very intense in terms of noise. Like they're so loud in there. And this one especially...
Dark.
There's lots of gunfire and shouting and screaming. Joel and Ellie, who are the main characters, they are represented as well. There are actors playing them. I didn't actually see Joel because one of the things you realise as well doing this for the first time is obviously the actors are, I don't know if they're on sort of timers, but they'll sort of jump out and then they'll duck back into wherever they were hiding and then they'll jump out again a few seconds later. So there is the potential, just based on pot luck really, that you might miss certain jump scares because they'll be resetting at the point that you walk past them. So I didn't actually ever see Joel.
I don't think I did either.
But I did see Ellie and she was a pretty good likeness actually. Yeah. She jumped out at one point and tells you to duck and sort of shoots at something behind you. And my Apple Watch, which is constantly when I'm at Arsenal games telling me it's too loud, you need to get out of here. It was doing that constantly in all of the houses, but I think especially this one.
I mean, because there's staff like dotted all through the mazes, who are keeping you going at a constant rate to walk through. So I think, like, so otherwise you're in danger. You might see one of the characters jump out, say, on the group in front of you. And then you kind of almost half expect them to jump out when your group goes through. But because they keep you constantly going through, you don't get that so much. So it keeps it quite fresh for each group. But they really tell you, if like you stop slightly or go abreast of each other, they tell you to get back in single file and keep moving through. So it's just a constant flow of people. But like you're saying, Tom, they reset so quickly. So you get someone jump out and then they just go back again, ready for, like, you know, the next couple that are coming through. So it's really, the timing is really good and they get really close to you. So if they jump out and they're holding, like you said, a gun or something like that, but it can feel as though it's really literally a couple of inches away from your face. So they're really good at judging the distance because they're not allowed to touch you and you're not allowed to touch them. But it I must was... admit, by the time you came out, I didn't know whether to laugh or to scream because it was so intense. My belly was aching afterwards because I just was like, it was a mix of like screaming and laughter, I think.
Yeah, I didn't, like I said, I didn't necessarily find, there were a couple of these houses that I did find creepier than the others, but for the most part, it was, yeah, adrenaline more than anything. And yeah, the actors are very well trained, like trained or, yeah, they just judge the distances so well. Like, it reminds me a little bit of when footballers sort of embarrassingly square up to one another and get really close to each other's faces without actually wanting to punch or headbutt each other. It feels like they get that close sometimes and just always stop just in time. But I can't remember which one it was specifically, but there were definitely a couple of occasions where I thought, oh gosh, I thought they were going to hit that guy or hit that lady, like they were, got that close. But yeah, I enjoyed The Last of Us Maze for the most part. It was very crash-bang wallop, as I said. So I'm sure there were loads of nods and references in there that a big fan would notice, but you're going through it so quickly that it is hard to kind of stop and appreciate it. But
they're so well hidden. All of them, aren't they, from like the main part of the park. So obviously we've been to the park a couple of times during the day before and you wouldn't have a clue that was all behind.
I think this one was off behind Men in Black. It was sort of off at that end of the park. The only other thing I'll say about The Last of Us is sort of just like a nerdy point for fans, really, but this is inspired by the game, not the TV show. It's not a inspired by the TV show that was inspired by the game situation. So the artwork for this maze, for example, shows Joel and Ellie as they appear in the game, and there is some the voice actors from the game come back for this. So when the live actors for Joel and Ellie jump out, you hear them shout and scream stuff to at you, and that is actually the actors from the games who recorded new lines for this haunted house. So that's quite a cool detail if you are a fan of the game.
There's a massive walk back out as well, wasn't there? So when you come out of that one and you're heading for the next one, you want to go, it's like it's sort of almost like the queue to get out seems to take almost as long as the queue to get in because you're just like...
Yeah, and in terms of once you get out of the house, so yeah, quite long walks back to get out, but quite often the exit is right next to the entrance to another one.
And it came out by E.T., wasn't it?
Yeah, by E.T., and in this case, it was Universal Monsters Unmasked. And so I think I'm right in saying that they do a house every year that is inspired by the classic Universal monsters. So, you know, The Mummy, Dracula, Frankenstein, whoever else. This year, there was I think Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Phantom of the Opera, The Invisible Man, one or two others make up the, I guess, Universal Monsters Avengers lineup this time. And it's set in the catacombs of Paris. I thought this was the best house by far. I didn't really know what to expect, but I thought sort of the production of it and the atmosphere and the variety of effects and areas that you walk through, this was probably the best one. And then right from the start, it kind of tries to set up a little bit more of a story because you had a guy up on a bridge kind of above you, kind of setting the scene. And some really impressive kind of fog and mist effects. And yeah, it did more than The Last of Us to kind of set up a bit of suspense before you actually properly went in.
And you kind of recognised all of the... The Invisible Man was another one, I think, wasn't it?
He was, yeah.
Yeah. And the Phantom of the Opera, like you're saying, going back to the catacombs of Paris that links in with that story. But wasn't that the one at the start where someone almost like falls?
No, that was towards the end. So that was one of the moments that really got me. That, you know, you've seen them do this trick on rides before, right? You know, on Jurassic Park, there's that bit where there's a crate hanging above you and it's shaking and then it falls just as you're going underneath it. And I think they do it on The Mummy as well. There's like a sliding door that it falls just as you go under it. And yeah, in this case, there's a kind of an archway up above you at one point, and there's a guy up there. I can't remember which character it is, but he then starts to fall off. And I thought he gets, again, kind of like the way the actors get really close to you when they come at you. He kept falling. He fell way further than I thought. And it makes you think, oh God, you know, how is this going to play out? Are they going to stop it at literally the very last second, or has something broken and he's going to hit the floor? It's very well done. Obviously he does stop, but it got me.
And those fog effects, like you were saying, at some point you really can't see where you're going because they're really dark in there anyway. And then you get the fog. And then a lot of the houses, you have these sort of plasticky screens that separate some of the parts of the house and that you have to sort of push your way through. It's like when you go into bat caves around some of the parks or something, and you have to go through those plastic curtain things and you have to push your hands through them. And some of them feel really horrible, and then you just go into this really foggy part, and you can't see anything. And so when the actors start jumping out of you, they really do make you jump.
I think the other thing that I liked about this one is that most of them, obviously you have to walk through single file still, but the others seem to be kind of built with that in mind. So it's sort of very narrow corridors, whereas this one actually opens up quite a bit at times. And it just makes it harder to judge where the scares are going to come from. I feel like more the actors jump out from a greater variety of positions on this one than on any of the other houses. So, yeah, I thought this one from production to scares was the best house, definitely my favourite. And it makes you, so I don't know if you know the new theme park they're building in Florida, Epic Universe. Yeah. The new Universal Parks. Yeah. So the rumours are is that they're going to have a whole land there dedicated to classic monsters. And yeah, just seeing how well they capture them in Horror Nights does make me even more excited to see what that land ends up being, because it might almost be a sort of all year round Horror Nights type experience.
Fitting for the horror show, the makeup show.
Yes, and yeah, the makeup show, which we'll talk about in our Universal trip report whenever we do that. But that show is still really good after all of these years.
That was good.
I think it was at this point that we stopped for a little bit of food, or maybe just me. So they have food trucks and food stands all around the park dedicated to Horror Nights, and some of the usual food locations also remain open, serving their usual menu in some cases, but in addition to that, some bespoke Horror Nights stuff. So the Today Cafe, for example, I think is serving basically their whole menu through the night, plus some like Halloween cupcakes and things like that. And then you'll have specific Halloween food stands. There's a Last of Us one, for example, that sells like a Cordyceps corn dog and things like that. We didn't really indulge in any of this. Generally speaking, it looked a bit style over substance, a lot of this food. And I also didn't think the vegan and veggie options looked amazing, generally speaking. It's not got the kind of variety of an Epcot food festival. So
to focus perhaps a bit more on the drinks as well. So lots of spooky looking cocktails.
Yeah, lots of people seem to turn up at Horror Nights, if not to get wasted. You know, I wouldn't dare suggest that, but there are definitely people there who go for a good time, let's say. Let's put it like that.
A lot of people dressing up as well, which is not what...
Well, a little bit, maybe. You're not really supposed to. I don't think you can wear masks, for sure.
Yeah.
But not as much as Disney. You know, we were at Magic Kingdom on a couple of days where there was a Halloween event coming up that evening, and it works much the same way as it does at Universal. The Halloween people tend to turn up a little bit before park closing as everyone else is leaving the park. And there you're very much encouraged to go in fancy dress, whereas at Universal, I think it's not so much the case. But yeah, I think I was the only one who had any specific Halloween food at all. I had vegan pizza fries. They are sold from the Woody Woodpecker Pizza Restaurant in Kid Zone. They were okay. It was a pretty generous portion of crinkle fries. So that was something a bit different because normally you just get standard straight fries in the theme parks. Covered in vegan mozzarella, vegan pepperoni, and some crumbled vegan sausage. It was pretty good.
They look nice.
Yeah, it was quite, as I say, it was quite a healthy portion. It's basically the same dish if people know the vegan tater tots at Green Eggs and Ham in Zeus Landing, which is exactly the same except they're tater tots and not fries. So it's exactly the same concept. So if you prefer fries to tater tots, you'll prefer these. And if it's vice versa, it's vice versa. But yeah, they filled a hole for sure. And I ended up chowing down on those while we got in the queue for the Darkest Deal, which I guess was the first kind of completely unique Horror Nights maze that we did. The setup for this one, I think I'm right in saying that a lot of these houses, in terms of where they've been set up, they're kind of in big kind of warehouse type buildings that I presume are there all year round.
It's like the back lock tour, weren't they?
Yeah. Whereas this one, you actually felt, or it felt like anyway, that you were going into a themed building that they had actually made for this.
Like a cabin.
House, yeah. Yeah. It was pretty cool, actually. I quite liked it. So the setup that they give is blues musician Pine Straw Spruce meets at a crossroads with a diabolical entity known as the Collector to make a deal. His soul for fame.
Yeah, it was like a shack that you, like the entrance looked like a bit like a cabin stroke shack. And I think there was like something that looked a bit like a scarecrow-y figure sitting outside and southern music playing.
It's like a blues jazz musician, right? And you kind of come up on him at various points throughout the house as increasingly horrible things are happening to him because as I say, he's given up his soul for a shot at being a famous singer. I seem to remember this was maybe the only one where Dad got scared.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think didn't someone jump out really close to him that he wasn't expecting.
I think so, yeah.
Literally within like a couple of inches of his face. And it was one that had that, one thing we haven't mentioned around the senses is like the smelling some of them.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them smelled really bad.
It was like a throwback to the original King Kong ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like they've been storing up some of those smells in jars ever since that ride closed,
yeah,
and they just go and smash them in the Halloween houses each year.
They smell really quite unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite musty and, yeah, just not that nice.
Yeah, no, I thought this one was pretty good. I had obviously no expectations going in because it's completely unique, but, yeah, I appreciated how I thought the theming extended more to the outside, so there was just more a sense of kind of intrigue going in than if you're just walking into a big warehouse, obviously.
Yeah, and like you said, didn't know what to expect because we didn't really know what the theme was. It wasn't one of the TV-related or game-related. It wasn't one of like the classic monster-related ones. I think because of that, it was probably be a bit more scary because you just didn't know who was going to jump out and what they were going to look like and where the story was going to go.
Mm. Yeah. I think after this, we stopped for others to have food, and we won't go into it because it wasn't anything Halloween specific. We just stopped off in Springfield and had some of the usual grub from there. And then after that, we kind of split our time between some of the scare zones and two more houses. So that's what's left for us to talk about on this episode. I guess you could count this. This isn't counted as a scare zone, but it kind of is because they have Death Eaters that come out in Diagon Alley, which I thought was really well done. So it's worth noting when we say this too, that Escape from Gringotts, the ride in Diagon Alley, is open. It's one of, I think, five rides that they keep open all night, along with Rip Ride Rocket, Transformers, Revenge of the Mummy, and Men in Black. Obviously, the majority of those rides are indoors. There's not really anything special about doing them during Horror Nights, but Rip Ride Rocket, of course, being outside and lit up is quite cool. Being able to do that in the dark. And I had been in Universal Studios After Dark a couple of times last year just to see the fireworks, but I'd never been in Diagon Alley After Dark. And before we sort of talk about the Death Eater specifically, just seeing it at night. I thought it was really cool. It looks very, it's a very photogenic area of the park anyway, but at night it looks even cooler. It's lit up really nicely. And obviously the dragon breathing fire looks even more striking. So I really liked it. But the Death Eaters walking around, yeah, it's kind of like a scare zone, and the scare zones are just parts of the park that you walk through that have been the most heavily decorated for Halloween, and you have scare actors walking around and they're kind of constantly on the move and jumping at people and that kind of thing. But in the case of the Death Eaters, I think they come out at specific times and it feels like they're a little bit more in character. It reminded me a bit more of maybe the Stormtroopers at Galaxy's Edge.
Exactly. So, and they interact, because they interact a bit with the people, don't they? Because the people sort of interacting with them, and they were doing it back. I always get mixed up with the Death Eaters and the Dementors.
The Dementors are the soulless creatures from Azkaban.
I don't know why I thought they were going to be floating around Diagon Alley. The Death. I kind of had them pictured in my head.
Death. Harry Potter fraud over here. But no, the Death Eaters, they're Voldemort's Nazi gang, aren't they, basically? But you had some guest who tried to have at it with a wand, you know, got their wand out from Harry Potter land and waved it at Death Eaters, and they didn't look very impressed. I think one of the guys who waved his wand at a Death Eater had like a Welcome to Florida shirt on with Florida in the shape of a gun on his back. So that was a bit unsettling.
Scary.
Yeah, but you know, Florida.
And then to kind of match up with the theme, we went and had nice ice cream.
Oh yeah, we went and had... butterbeer ice cream.
Not very Halloweenish.
No, can't go wrong. Nice. But yeah, obviously if you turn up at Halloween Horror Nights, you're going to want to prioritize doing the houses. That's, I would assume, the main reason why anyone would turn up to this. But I do think it's worth making time to go and see Diagon Alley. It's pretty cool. Unfortunately, they don't do this kind of thing at the other Harry Potter land in Islands of Adventure. There's no Halloween stuff over there. I think they have done bits and bobs in the past. I think they've done like a cool projection show on Hogwarts Castle before, but they're not doing anything this year, and there's certainly no Death Eaters roaming the streets of Hogsmeade or anything, which, I don't know, I think that would be kind of cool. But yeah, it's just at Studios and just in Diagon Alley.
I think the thing to mention as well, Tom, in Diagon Alley and the scare zones, it takes a completely different atmosphere once the light goes and it becomes dark. So going through scare zones when it was still light was a bit weird. But once it got dark, especially the first night we were there, it got a lot scarier. And because it's the first time, you don't really realise what's going to happen in the scare zone. So we came out of Diagon Alley and we were walking back towards the mummy. I think that's the first... That's the scare zone that we'd gone through.
Yeah, that one was, Shipyard 32, Horrors Unhinged. So this is in the San Francisco part of the park, you know, where the San Fran Pastry Company is and where Jaws used to be. Some creepy nonsense going on.
There's that shop where, like, a photo shop place just to the...
Oh, where they, like, Photoshop you into movie scenes.
And a character came out of there and he was like, black mask, but when he came towards you, almost like was faceless, he just had like this, I don't know, a bit like the Last of Us type of face. And he just came up at us and absolutely scared the whatnot out of us, because like you kind of looked under this cape and there was just nothing there. He did it twice, I think.
Did you find the scare zone scarier than the houses generally?
I think the first one, yes. Because it's quite difficult to see. So people walk towards you, and I know this sounds really weird, but at times you kind of like think it might just be a guest. And suddenly it gets really close and you realise, no, it's one of the actors.
Yeah.
So it's a bit weird.
Yeah.
Especially if they're in like a sort of black hoodie type thing with the hood come up, you know, because you just don't kind of realise until they're really close to you.
I was fine with it because it's basically just like walking home from Dartford Station late at night. So it's not really a big problem for me. The other scare zone that we did, it kind of led straight on from that one, was Vamp 69, Summer of Blood. So this is, I think it's basically a school disco that's been infiltrated by vampires.
Yeah.
So they're playing a lot of like 60s 60s music. At one point, they played Sweet Caroline, didn't they? Which just made me think I was at a football match.
Yeah, because me and Becky were like, we were walking through them arm in arm, thinking like, you know, the two of us together. And we thought, if you don't make eye contact with them, they don't get too close. So we just walked through there singing along to...
I think they pick on people who clearly are trying to avoid them.
Yeah.
I was walking through quite happily filming the whole thing and having, and they didn't really come for me. But yeah, I think if you're kind of, if you're clearly nervous or clearly trying to avoid them, then they know, they realise that and they go for you.
Because what they do is they kind of walk as though they're just going to go past you. And at the last possible minute, they veer and just get right in your face. So you think like you're going to go past them with no problem, and then they just come right into you. And that's, and you're just kind of like, ugh. But yeah, I think that if they see you're going to get scared or scream or interact with them a bit more, then they come towards you more. But that I think was the longest zone. And the other thing on that one is that they use the fog really cleverly again. So you don't necessarily see anyone coming towards you until the last minute, because there's a lot of mist and fog going across the road. And I think that's where the exit to that Halloween, the big Halloween shop was as well. So you kind of come out of there and you're straight into the fog and you can miss them completely.
Yeah, that's the tribute store. So I think that changes over the course of the year. They sort of dedicate it to different franchises or what have you, depending on kind of what's going on. So I was a bit disappointed because for a long chunk of this year, it's been it was a Jurassic Park tribute store, because it's the 30th anniversary of Jurassic Park and it looked really amazing. And I think we missed it by about a week, and then it turned into Halloween, unfortunately. But I guess it's not a bad time just to mention that. I was a bit disappointed by the Halloween merchandise, mainly because I thought, well, I just want a pin badge. How hard can it be?
We look everywhere.
And there's not really a this is the Horror Nights pin badge. There's a mystery box of Stranger Things pins. There was a Chucky pin that was like 40% off the whole time because clearly nobody wanted it. And the only other one I saw was kind of meant for annual pass holders. So, you know, I couldn't lie to myself and get that one. But, you know, Disney, for example, will not miss a trick when it comes to an event pin badge. You know, I got an Epcot Food and Wine Festival one this year. I got a Disney 100 Years one. Last year, I got a Disney World 50th Anniversary one. And
I got a Minnie Mouse one, which I probably lost.
Oh, yeah. Really, yeah. Generally, Universal sell plenty of nice pin badges. You know, I got a couple last year that I really like. I got a cool Velocicoaster one, I think, and I've got some, you know, that are 20 years old that are cool. But yeah, no, just here's the sort of Horror Nights artwork on a pin badge. I was a bit disappointed, and
so you did get the Stranger Things one, and you were really disappointed with the
quality. I mean, I kind of expected it, but it was very much
like square or rectangle.
If this is the only option, I'll get it, I guess. And it didn't help that I got what basically two of the blandest pins that you could have got. So I was a bit disappointed. What else did we get Horror Nights-wise? Dad got a mug. It was a good mug, actually.
I think the best things they had, the themed merchandise, were either the mugs or the glasses.
Mugs, glasses. We've got some nice coasters themed to different houses. Last of Us one, Stranger Things one, and Exorcist one, I think.
Yeah.
The t-shirts and the hoodies and stuff, I hope you like wearing black. They're basically all black. There are a couple of exceptions. There's like a Stranger Thing. There's a Hellfire Club one, a white Hellfire Club with black sleeves. That seemed quite popular. You saw a lot of people wearing that. But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed with the merch, to be honest. But anyway, it's sold all over the shop, not just in that tribute store, but in the main shop. And there are stores all over the place.
And City Walk, there was like a huge display in that big shop on the corner.
I think if you're ready to spend money, there are lots of opportunities to do it.
As ever.
We ended our first night here with two houses. So the first one, or the penultimate one, was Dueling Dragons, I think, Choose Thy Fate. So this is an homage, I suppose, to Dueling Dragons, the old roller coaster ride. In fact, I think I heard people in the queue, I think there were two guys, and one was clearly asking the other, like, what's the deal with this house? And he said, I think it's based on some really old ride, which made me feel really, really old, because I remember Dueling Dragons, although I think I was never quite tall enough to ride it at the time until it became Harry Potter. So this was an old dueling roller coaster in Islands of Adventure in the Lost Continent area, Fire and Ice, Red and Blue. You picked which one you wanted to do. And
I really like that ride. I never went on it.
I mean, it was still very good when they made it Harry Potter themed. They just called it Dragon Challenge, although I think by then they had stopped the coasters going quite so close to one another for, I guess, safety reasons, which meant it wasn't quite as exciting as it used to be. But it's long been gone, and that's now where Hagrid is. This maze tried to kind of recreate that feel. The setup is kind of similar in terms of it's two dragons who are fighting. I think two warlocks that have been turned into dragons that are fighting. And at the end, there's like a split path, and you choose which way you want to go, and it will be different. Your ending will be different depending on which one you pick. I can't imagine it's hugely different, but it's kind of a neat idea. But I thought this one was better on paper than in practice. I thought this was one of the goofier ones, and the scare actors, and they look like Doctor Who extras, really. And I think it, more so than any other, obviously you said earlier, the whole thing takes on a much more scary, sinister vibe when it's dark. But more than any other scare actors, if you'd seen these guys in broad daylight, you would just think they looked ridiculous. I don't know what the vibe they were going for was. I think it's sort of like dragon people. They kind of had scales and horns, and some of them had sort of fangs. But
you're right. It was like
they looked a bit naff.
Old Doctor Who, like when you used to watch before your time, Doctor Who from like years ago, like Tom Baker type episodes, when the monsters were not great, should we say. But I don't really remember that one that well either. So perhaps that's also a testament to that it wasn't the most.
I think it was also another thing, that in the same way that if you're going through the houses and they happen to be resetting a scare as you walk past it, you can consider yourself a bit unlucky. You're also maybe a bit unlucky if while you're queuing for one of these houses, they are changing the actors. So it's obviously not the same actors doing this for 10, 12 hours or whatever. They'll do shifts. And occasionally you'll see a horde of actors often wearing like cloaks or gowns to kind of hide. To hide some of their costumes. But you'll just see them walking into, a back way into the house. And that also kind of maybe spoils the magic a little bit. And I think that happened to us while we were waiting for Dueling Dragons.
And that's reset really quick, because you would like, I mean, it didn't hold up the queue for hardly any time at all, did it?
No, I would put Dueling Dragons towards the bottom of my personal list, I think. And then the last one we did on night one was The Exorcist Believer. So the queue for this is mostly snaking around by that stage area outside the Rip Ride Rocket. This, I think more than any other house, was probably a marketing exercise because they just put out a new Exorcist film. Not sure if it's a remake or a sequel or a prequel or whatever, but new Exorcist film just came out. And this one I thought was actually quite refreshing because it kind of did what I insinuated earlier in terms of what tends to make me more scared, which is that there's a lot more suspense and build up. You actually walk through quite long stretches of this one without anything really happening. And it means that when the scares do come, I was a bit more on edge. So they got me a little bit more than the ones that are just an onslaught of scares.
I seem to remember it wasn't as dark, so you could... There was walking around, she was laying on the bed or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
There was like more space. So you were kind of like walking around. And as you're walking around, you're just thinking she's just going to come up. She's just going to jump up. And I don't think she did. And that, like you said, that builds attention even more because you're expecting something to happen and it doesn't. And then obviously you get into the next bit and it does. But there seemed to be more space and you could see. It was more visible, I think, because the lighting was brighter in that one.
Yeah, they did some clever stuff with shadows and projections. There's a bit where you walk past a stairway, I seem to remember, and you see the shadow of this creepy little girl at the top of the stairs sort of beckoning towards you. And then I thought I think this was the final scene, but again, a bit like what I appreciated about Universal Classic Monsters, is that you're not just being shepherded through a narrow corridor the whole time. There's a bit where you go into a slightly more open plan room and there's a possessed girl sort of strapped to a chair in the middle and you don't quite know when she's going to sort of launch herself off the chair towards the guests as they walk around. Again, I wasn't in the right place at the right time for this one, but as a concept, I thought that was quite cool. And I actually watched a video of this one before we did it, and that particular scene did look really intense. So, yeah.
It goes back to, I think, as well, when you're in like the single file, because you might miss someone jumping out, but then I would hear, say, Becky absolutely scream her head off behind me and like drag the shoulder strap on my bag down, and I'm going like, should I look behind? No, I'm not going to look behind. I won't look behind. So it was almost like hearing other people scream almost got your senses going more than seeing it yourself.
Yeah.
So you know what was going on.
Yeah. And that was that. We decided to head home after that. So I think by the time we were done with that and had a quick peruse in the gift shop, we were probably, midnight almost?
Oh, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we'd been in that park for about 8 hours, which if you'd spent 8 hours in Universal on just a normal day, 9 to 5, that would be a long, long theme park day. So, yeah, to do it.
That was the day I think my legs were killing me, because being of a certain age, and I find standing in queues and not moving is like more tiring on your legs than constantly moving, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So my legs were so tired by the end of that day. And then you had, so when we went into the car park, we were a long way from the park as well, weren't we?
Yeah, that's another, just as an aside, I feel like every year we go to Universal, they are screwing over the people who don't pay for preferred parking even more. And yeah, it's a long trek back to the car if you haven't paid for the premium parking.
Which I think was, I'd go up to $50, I think.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was $30 for normal parking.
Yeah.
Which does build up if you've got like a 2-week pass.
Yeah. But so at the end of your first night, were you happy to have done it and looking forward to round two? Or were you thinking, oh, God, what have I done?
I think part of me was going like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to, like, you know, recharge before the next night. But, yeah, we'd kind of, like, paid for the tickets for the second night. And I think did think even leaving at midnight, we'd only done half of the houses. So,
Yeah, I think in hindsight, we did waste, I thought, too much time mucking around looking for somewhere to eat. So I would go with a bit more of a plan in mind for the kind of stuff. Like if you want to hit up certain themed food trucks or what have you, then maybe go with. I think if you faff around and don't quite know what you want to do, you can sort of lose. Or eat beforehand, which is what we did on night two, and we just felt less in need of food over the course of the second night and got a lot more done in a short space of time as a result.
Your water bottle. Do you remember how much they charged us for a bottle of water in the queue?
Oh, that was the worst moment of any theme park visit in the whole 3-week trip, was being charged $6 for a bog standard bottle of water in the queue for the Exorcist maze. That was truly horrendous. But we'll leave it there for this episode of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to Mum for making her debut. And we'll be back soon with a second episode about Halloween Horror Nights. And then over the coming weeks and months, trip reports from all the other parks that we did in Florida on this trip. There's some Horror Nights pictures and videos and stuff on some of our socials. So if you go to links.parkrush.com, you'll find links to all of those. And if you want to get in touch with the show, the best way to do that is to email podcast@parkrush.com. Thanks very much once again. Catch you next time. Bye.